and welcome to 10 Very Big Books, a Malazan read-through podcast. My name is Peter Bond, and I've read each book in the main series. However, my co-hosts are reading the series for the first time. With me today is my friend and closest confidant, India Jones.
Hello!
How's the watermelon, Inj?
It's good. It's good. It's satisfying.
And our producer, AJ Flary, is with us. How are the levels? How are the bars?
The levels are looking great, especially on India's watermelon eating sounds.
I'm not eating it. Perfect. I'm not even eating it. I'm
She's
chuckling.
Just holding it like a prop. And he's and last but not least, he's begrudgingly accepted the title of Fist. It's Joshua Baker.
You know, fun fact, I've always been more of a cantaloupe kind of guy. I have never really enjoyed watermelon, but like I'll fuck a cantaloupe up right now.
You heard it here first. Josh Baker will fuck a cantaloupe.
Josh said he's gonna fuck a cantaloupe.
I said I fucking
That's
ate all of you.
Full stop what you just said, Josh.
Cantaloupe does have that kind of vibe, I'm not gonna lie.
This is the show where we sometimes talk to New York Times best-selling author Steven Erickson and also talk about Josh fucking
just loves the book. He just loves the curvy melons.
Oh my god. I fucking hate
today on
you.
The show we're talking about House of Chains chapters 5, 6, and 7. We've left the big Carsa opening behind, and we're catching up with everybody else on Seven Cities. I'm excited to get into it.
I'm not.
I'm excited to get out of it.
These chapters sucked.
Like, Inj, we're going to disagree so hard, because I know you texted to the group that, but, like, these chapters absolutely ruled. I'm on cloud nine over here, loving this House of Chains.
Yeah, I also like these chapters.
They were fine.
All right. Well, let's talk about them more in depth. Chapter 5 is super long. Does anyone read the summary?
Can I read the summary?
No, because,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my
get
gosh.
In there, AJ? A,
what?
I fucking, fucking get in
get
there
in
like
there.
Swimwear,
it's
buddy.
A great day.
Let's get it going.
Chapter 5. In Erin, Gamut has been named Fist. The former House Guard captain is working with Commander Blistig to track down the archer Squint. They find the archer drunk in a tavern. They talk about the slaughter of Coltane in the front of the city. Gamut plans to have Squint cleaned up. Blistig tries to mock Gamut, but the Fist puts him down and informs him the adjunct Tavor has called a command meeting that night. Fiddler draws close to Erin, however he is leaving his old life behind and taking a new name. Strings. He meets the noble-born Lieutenant Rannell, and they argue. Soon, he meets Korik. They speak of Admiral Nock, the Chain of Dogs, and the situation in Seven Cities. Lestari Yil waits in a bar after receiving a mysterious message. The Red Blades have been freed and serve the new adjunct. The Claw Pearl soon arrives, asking Lestari to accompany him on a secret mission. She is skeptical, and they set off to find out more. Gamut waits with the others for Tavor. The group is Admiral Nock, Commander Blistig, and the Red Blade Commander, Tene Beralta. Tavor arrives and unceremoniously dispatches three orders. First, Blistig and Beralta will both serve as fists for the army. She waits to give Nock his orders, and the commanders leave. Second, she calls upon the Wiccan. Nil and Nether join the army to serve as Tavor's mages, and the young Tamul will lead the Wiccan as bodyguards for the adjunct. Third, she meets with Pearl and Lestari Yil. Away from the Empress's eyes, she teases Pearl with the idea of finding the Talon. She gives them clues and then tells Pearl to dispose of them. She asks them to find her sister Felicin. Gamut recalls the day of the noble Kull in Unta. He dismissed the house guards besides the Talon, Bodin. Gamut commands Bodin to protect Felicin and follow her to the Otateral Mines. Bodin sets off to wake Felicin. Pearl and Lestari Yil are left alone. They speak about their mission. Pearl hopes to reveal the Talons and curry favor with the Empress and the Imperial Claw. Lestari is hesitant, but can't get out. She agrees to go on the mission. Tavor and Gamut meet with the Admiral Nock. Together, they discuss the Emperor, his old guard, and what comes of the Napan Admiral. They talk for a while about Imperial history and how Lassine has shattered that old guard. Then Tavor leaves to find T'Amber. Strings will serve under Captain Keneb, under Fist Gamut. He then meets up with Korik and his new squadmates, Smiles, Bottle, and Tar, who Strings names as his corporal. Fiddler then encounters Stormy and Gessler. They recognize they both served in the Old Empire. Together, the soldiers go off to trade stories.
We're back in Eren with Adjunct Tavor and the 14th Army, and we catch up with a lot of different people and what's going on there, but it starts with the new Fist Gamut, who was the old Perrin guardhouse captain, and now he's Tavor's brought him along and promoted him. And we first meet him as he's out in the city with Blistig trying to find Squint, the archer who killed Coltane. India, what was your impression of Gamut, and how did you feel being back with the Malazan army?
I felt upset. They bore the shit out of me.
Inge, no.
I know. Gamut. Did we meet this person before?
Nah, brand new character.
Wow, that name sounds familiar AF. So
he has been obliquely mentioned as them of having a nap in guard before, but you wouldn't have known. So
remembered that, yeah.
Yeah.
So first I have a question because I forgot and I didn't know their name and I feel like I should know this. Who is the person who was like, no, we're not leaving the gates? Like, we're just going to let them all die.
Oh, that's Malagrel.
I would love if, real quick, if we could do a quick recap, because I was also struggling.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, because then I was like, maybe it's this Bliss Creek. I don't even know.
What So can I try?
Sure, yeah, give it a shot.
Gaps? Okay.
You're talking about going over the events of Coltane's slaughter outside of Eren.
Correct.
And towards the end of Deadhouse Gates, when Coltane's approaching, okay? So, Duiker and a few guys had gotten into the city.
Mm-hmm. With the refugees.
So they want to go sally forth and save the group, but they are stopped by, if I remember correctly, High Fist Pormqual?
Yes. He was currently the fist.
He was the current fist then, and he was being advised by Malagrel, yes?
Indeed.
And did we know any... What I can't remember is, I know what we find out later, but who was Malagrel supposed to be? Was he just a guy? Was he a sorcerer?
At the very beginning of Deadhouse Gates, Malagrel is there with the council, and then Coltane kind of spurs him and is rude to him. And Malagrel is kind of, he's there, and he's not with other people. He's just supporting the rebellion. He's kind of playing his own game. You know?
Okay, and so at the end, and then they go out to Corbolo Dom, mm-hmm. who is the renegade fist.
Yeah.
Pornqual orders everyone to put their swords down, and they all get killed. Now, Pornqual gets killed, too.
Yes, Pornqual dies there.
Malagrel does or doesn't die there?
No, Malagrel goes and he goes off to Raraku, and we'll talk about him in Chapter 7.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to remember. Okay, Blistig is the leader of the group of guards that Duiker convinced to turn back and close the gates.
You'll recall when they're watching Coltane slaughter, Blistig's up on the wall. And
yes.
Duiker notes that he's the only one that is there that's kind of like, he's outraged that they're not doing anything. And he's like, we should go out, but he is being stopped by High Fist Pornqual and Malagrel, and because he's the commander of the Eren Guard.
And now when they sally forth, and he's the one that gets sent back by Duiker, right? Duiker's like, this doesn't make sense, go back?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
and
cool.
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I had too, India. I was really struggling.
That helps. No, that's it. That's what I needed.
I always get Corbolo Dom and Malagrel and the third one. I never remember who's who.
It's annoying, too, because I'm scared to, like, fact-check myself.
Yes, dangerous stuff.
But, yeah, okay. So, yeah, that makes sense, then, because they were giving, like, as Steve does, an excruciating amount of fucking detail about these two men. And I was like, I thought we knew them already, but okay, makes sense. We didn't. Why is one of them kind of crazy?
Blistig's got a lot of pent-up rage, and I think it's just because of that he had to witness that slaughter, kind of was unable to.
Oh, it's rage. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I was confused to be back and unhappy because I don't like them. It's boring to me. And so this whole chapter was like, I as I mentioned to you guys, I would like read a paragraph and then complain in the group chat and then read a paragraph and then go on my Instagram.
You were immersed in the world of fantasy.
It was hard for me to get through this. So,
okay.
Yeah. So I thought that they were just normal characters. Disinterested. I have no thoughts. I'm not interested in them at all.
Well, we'll touch in more on Gamut later, but Josh, how did you feel when we come to meet Fiddler? He's going by Strings now. He meets Korok, and later on he meets this whole other squad. So what do you think of Fiddler? Let's talk about both parts right now, and his new, he's come to fight for the cause here on Seven Cities.
Yeah, so I do want to first point out a funny parallel between AJ and I. I read this chapter a few days ago, and I texted Peter, and I said, is it supposed to be super clear that this is Fiddler, like, from the get? And then yesterday, AJ messaged us all and was just like, the Fiddler reveal, guys!
I said, I felt really dumb that I didn't get the Fiddler reveal.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. Here's what I'll say about everything to do with Fiddler so far, is I'm very split based upon how Steve has written in other books. So, like, part of me goes, I don't give a fuck about any of these people. They have to live at least two chapters before I learn their names and anything, and I'll go back and recall what they look like. But the other problem is, I didn't learn anything. I didn't, like, pick her and blend. The entire time we read Memories of Ice, I was like, I don't care about them. They're not important. And then they're incredibly important and live through the end, and I probably should really go back and, like, review some baseline details about what they look like and stuff. So I don't know any of the names of the new Fiddler people, except, and the only thing I know about them is I don't like his lieutenant.
Lieutenant Ronald.
Yeah. Oh, I love seeing Stormy and Gessler in the gang, though. That was fun.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
Really, though?
Oh, yeah.
They're going to go and chill out? Please.
Okay.
I don't know. I will say this is probably the, I mean, we haven't seen tons of, like, in the Malazan army stuff, you know, but if I could have picked any weird collection of people to be my eyes into the Malazan army, I think this will be cool. Also, big reveal, or maybe not reveal, that Stormy and Gessler are also highly important people from before the weird shit. Is that a reveal?
It's not really a reveal. It was kind of hinted at in Deadhouse Gates, but not as explicitly.
Yeah, so I guess that was something.
I just like Stormy and Gessler a lot, you know? They're big bears.
They're fun. What's the other one? What's the young guy's name? The new one?
Oh,
Isn't there another one of them that's golden and going to be a god, and they barely talk about him because he was so new?
Yeah.
What's his fucking name?
Truth?
Truth.
Truth. Truth.
I was blanking.
Good job, guys.
Proud of you, AJ.
Thanks, AJ.
That's why I have my book.
Ah. You bastard.
Now, India, you may have been a little cool on the Gamut stuff, but I know for a whole book now you were thinking, what's going on with Lestara Yil? Where is she at?
I welcome any female character, so...
I'm just going to put in the clip from Deadhouse Gates where India said, Lestart mattering.
Who even are you?
Lestara, more like Lestart mattering, idiot.
Yeah, let's stop talking.
Oh, got her.
Got him. it's just, yeah, it was interesting to catch up with her and freaking Pearl. Pearl's such a bitch. I can't take him. She's just like, I don't know. She's addicted to the drama, though. Like, I can't even feel bad for her because as soon as he comes back, she's like, oh, no, I don't want this. Leave me alone. And then she's like, all right, yeah, what do you got for me? Like, let's go figure it out. What's the stuff? So
it is just lip service to not wanting to. I'm not going to go. Oh, hello, it's me. All right, you got me.
don't twist my arm. I'm coming. So that was like, I mean, am I excited for, they're going to go look for Felicin, right?
Yeah. We learn that later.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm excited about it because, like, what's going to come of it? But I'm also like, I just feel like Pearl's going to kill a bunch of people for no reason. It's going to piss me off. And Lestara's going to be like, what are you doing? Murder. And he's like, no, it's not murder. What do you mean murder?
I mean, to be so, fair, yeah, Lestara kills a fair amount of people too.
Yeah,
Lestara's like
part of the Red Blades, like, okay, so okay. Far they exclusively kill people.
She was just following orders.
And classically, whoa! That excuses all crimes.
That classic moral.
No, just kidding. Yeah, super bad.
Josh, how did you feel to see Lestara and Pearl? We learn that this duo is back together and they're off on this kind of, they get this furtive quest to go find Felicin.
I'll talk about the quest. I think that's very interesting. I love that like Pearl is so obsessed with finding the talents, you know, that's like a cool, I don't know. I thought that was interesting. As far as the characters themselves, I'm pretty cold on them. I don't care enough about Lestari. I feel like Lestari Yil is, I don't know. I don't know anything about her, and I feel no strong desire to learn about her currently. Correct. Maybe that'll change, you know, but right now they're both very one-dimensional, and I'm sure, as almost every character in this book is, by the end they'll be four-dimensional, and, you know.
I feel like we have a small smile right now, Peter, which leads me to believe that at some point she will become quite relevant, which is going to piss me off when I think back to this episode when they're like, fuck her.
Yeah.
So,
So, AJ, I'll shoot you this big fun question.
Ooh.
You know, okay. Let's get a little frisky. So, in this chapter, we really meet the adjunct Tavor for the first time, you know? She's been offhandedly mentioned or, like, seen through a little bit in Deadhouse Gates, a little bit other times. But what's your first impression of Tavor when she hands out all the orders and when you see her in this chapter?
I mean, she's very disinterested in a way. She just seems very concerned about how other people are viewing her. So she tries to give off as little as possible, you know, like when they all come into the meeting, it was kind of just like, here's what's happening. Here we go. OK, now I'm going to meet in private with my best friends. and then even in there was like some, you know, sly, like nudge stuff with Pearl and whatnot. But even that was still pretty like deadpan, I felt. Do keep in mind that I only read the first half of Deadhouse Gates and Memories of Ice, and she's not mentioned a whole lot in Memories of Ice, so I didn't have like this big expectation of who she would be and stuff. I feel like she's talked about a lot more in like Deadhouse Gates, and at least addressed in Gardens of the Moon. But
for not knowing a lot about how she's like talked about, I feel like you talked about her exactly how the book has talked about her. Like, caring about what people think.
India, do you feel like you had a big expectation about her?
No, I mean, I kind of took it a little differently, her, like, demeanor, because I feel like she is, like, she's just in a really weird, not safe position. So for her to give away any kind of emotion would be, like, she doesn't know who she can trust, and she doesn't even know, like, she's just not very secure.
Definitely.
So I think it makes sense that she's like withdrawn and like making decisions without really discussing them because she doesn't really know who to trust. I think I kind of like her for that. I'm kind of excited. I hope she has like a more interesting character development because I'd love to find out a little more about her. I thought it was like cute though that she does want to find Felicin. I mean, it's too little too late, girlfriend. You're not going to like what you find, but you know, at least she's not like a monster. Like, well, I mean, she's kind of a monster, but like at least she's redeemable. And she's not as bad as that freaking thing from the last book that was totally redeemable. So, like, I don't even care.
Can I hop in?
Please.
Of course.
I love the adjunct Tavor.
What?
Because I hate Felicin.
Oh.
Okay. I can't believe you still hate Felicin.
I love Tavor and Felicin. You don't have to pick one.
Here's the thing.
Me
Tavor,
too.
Tavor comes in and she just does. She walks in and she goes, boom, 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 you're all three promoted, no fanfare, next. And it's just like, I don't know, when she is in business mode, all I felt like everything she just chose to do was like precisely like so carefully thought out and brilliantly executed. I loved every, like she just commands a room in a way that Felicin can't because everyone looks at Felicin and goes, she has potential or she could kill us all the just because she's upset with us. Yes, Tavor is a little snippy with Gamut in a way, but like they both definitely deeply respect. Well, not only about respect. Gamut definitely like is very trusting of her versus like, I feel like everything Felicin does, all the people under her are like, I don't know. I can't trust that right now. I don't know. I love Tavor.
I think what's interesting about using the phrase commands a room, because I agree she commands a room, right? But I think her command is coming from how kind of withdrawn she is. And what and what she is withholding, you know, that's where the power is. So it's interesting to contrast her strength coming from holding back.
I think that's a classic from all the Malazan leaders we've seen. That is the Malazan way. Like the way you're a great leader is holding in what they don't need to know and only giving them what they need to see right that second. Following the playbook.
It is a Malazan way. And after she dispatches these orders, Gamut kind of thinks back to when he kind of helped send Bowden to protect Felicin, and we learn more about Tavor's first attempt to protect her sister. Mm. India, what did you think of seeing this kind of little flashback to this first attempt, and did it make you think about the events of Deadhouse Gates any differently?
No, I don't think so. I just don't agree with her choice to have done it, regardless of her thinking that.
Fully agree, Inge.
Yeah, like even, and it's not like, I don't know who said it, but somebody, she was like, oh, well, I hope she's okay in there. And somebody was like, well, she definitely won't be, but like, let's hope she's resilient. And if that's not enough for you to be like, oh, maybe not, she's like 13. Like, I don't know, I disagree with that decision and I don't feel bad. And I think that she was really shitty for doing it and nothing's gonna change that.
Fully agree. And I think some of the worst shit is when, I don't know who's, maybe Bowden or Gammon said, they're like, well, as long as she's like cooperative with Bowden,
yeah,
and then like everything will be okay. And it's like, yeah, maybe, or you could not send her to a slave camp as a child. Do you know what I mean? I don't know, man. It's like, I know there's like, there was pressure in the Imperial capital, but I just don't think Tavor gets a pass in any way. You know,
I agree. There were options, and she definitely picked by far the most brutal, I think, of the options. So I don't know what they were, but like, there had to be something. There had to be somewhere else this poor girl could have went.
Yeah,
I think it's a very in the moment decision, just judging from the portion in the book. Because Bowden says there will be some referring to harm coming to her. It cannot be helped. And Gamut's like, Gamut's basically just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Are you dumb? We could do something else. And then Bowden basically says, it's either the mob or the mines. And in that moment, I think Gamut's just like, well.
But I just like don't believe Bowden with that. I just think that's a fucking false choice, you know?
Agreed.
But like, it feels like a very heated, like in the moment, like, oh shit, we need to make a decision. And I agree, it probably could have been not the mines, but just like somewhere that's not there.
Do you wonder if she had to in order to cement her spot as adjunct?
Well, yeah, that she felt after Perrin deserted and all that, it was to reaffirm the House Perrin's loyalty to the Empress. That was what motivated that. But
why have we learned yet how she was chosen as the next adjunct?
It has not been discussed.
Okay, thank you. Very curious.
Now, Josh, speaking of the Empress, you text a little bit about it, but we learn a lot more about in this time about Admiral Nock, the Imperial history, Kellenved and Dancer, and how the Empire was kind of founded, and then how Lassine kind of broke away, and we get all this old guard history. So
this is my exact shit. I was in love. India's shaking her head, but yeah, this was,
don't even ask me.
I feel like I understand the books 4 times as well as I did before reading this. Like, I feel like so many things have locked in.
Why do you feel that way?
Yeah, please.
So I have said from the get-go that it is a beautiful storytelling device that we're thrown into a history, but we're not given a book, you know, any of the stuff before. Like, we're thrown into a living world, but we don't get that history element. And I felt like this was the first time that I like have a clear image of what the fucking Malazan Empire is. You know, how long it lasted, how had the change in power. I feel like I feel like in the time between where Gardens of the Moon began and Kellenved meeting Dancer, I feel like I have like a 80% grasp on now, whereas before I had like a 20% grasp.
Interesting.
And I'm sure there's tons I still don't know, but like, I know the pivotal moments of like Surly, now Lassine, I see where she went. I see why the idea of Nappens being just like, I understand the disappearances a little bit more and why they're where they need to be, like the fucking keeper, assumedly. If that's not one of them, I'll eat my own shoe. you know, I don't know. I felt really good, like in terms of my understanding of the precipitatory events leading to book one.
Of contextualizing that history of how the Empire came to be.
Yes, yes.
I enjoyed that history, and it's just a fun image, you know, and I just them all around, you know, making a little empire out of that bar, you know, dead
house.
Well,
and it's something I've struggled with since the first book is like, when I hear empire, I don't think 30 years old, you know, I don't think has existed for however many years. I know 30 was just a shot in the dark, you know.
Yeah, it's not 30, like, it, but continue.
Like, yeah. But I now I understand, like, oh, the Empire literally was created by these two guys who are in living memory. That is how long it has existed. That really also contextualizes how efficient the Malazan army is to have expanded the empire as much as they have in that short a time.
Yeah, and yeah, they had help with the Logres Talana Mass. It's a whole thing, but
yes, we'll
get to it. Yeah.
I mean, having an all-powerful undead army, I guess, probably quickened some things.
Yeah. Well, let's continue to chapter 6, but before we did, this is our first opportunity to thank those people who have backed us on Patreon, and this is our first episode we're recording since that was released, and there'll probably be more names than normal since it's our first time, and everyone who came in. We want to thank them. It's very nice, and everyone's been very kind and generous about it.
We're going to shout out the 26 people that backed today. This is the first day that we had our Patreon, but I guess, do we want to take it in shifts?
Yeah. I want to do it.
Start it off, India.
Thank you to Erin, Kai, Jonas, Enrique, Ben, Captain Britain, Bjorn, Panny,
Daniel, Alexandros, Vishnu Karthik, Nathan, Bill, Rick,
Josh, not Baker, Brendan, Flo Flo, Patrick, PMDU, Anthony,
Timothy, Jonathan, Bjorn, Use Chicken, and Brian. It's almost like a song, you know, you could do a little rhythm.
And Alexander, we had another person back while we were recording, so also Alexander.
Thank you all.
Thank you all so much.
That's
really,
you.
We are truly blown away by the amount of people who have contributed.
And for our August bonus episode, which will be this month, we're going to do a follow-up role-playing episode, more Malazan role-playing. So that should be a lot of fun. We're looking forward to making it for you.
Thank you, everyone.
We'll be here all week.
I'm sure we'll continue to plug and talk about the Patreon. So onward and upward to Chapter 6.
Chapter 6. At Absalar's home on Itko Khan, Crocus waits for her as she mourns her father's death. They wonder what is next for the two of them, reflecting on a job they did together, killing a man for money. Crocus, now going by Cutter, reflects on Cotillion. Kalam rides in the Warren of Shadows. He spots strange pillars at the children training with Manala. Cotillion approaches and questions the assassin. After trying to withdraw information from the god, Kalam agrees to help Cotillion to learn more about potential enemies. Crocus waits on the beach, and Cotillion then approaches the aspiring Cutter. Cotillion speaks to him about the Hound of Shadow, Ralik Nam, and assassins. The god offers to bless Crocus' dagger, and though he refuses, Cutter agrees to help the patron of assassins. Crocus goes to find Absalar. She has felt Cotillion's presence. The two are to go find an island. Onrak, a Talana Mass, is trapped in the Nascent. He has been separated from his people and cannot reach out to his kin or escape the Warren. He wanders, considering the strange world and his people, the Logros Talana Mass. Onrak finds the chained Tisti Eater, Troll Sengar. He bears a slash on his face to mark him as a traitor. He has been in prison for a long time. Onrak drags him to find food, and they both identify themselves as clanless. Strange large catfish attack them, and they fight them off. They manage to eat them, and Troll speaks of the Tisti Eater's past. Onrak is hesitant to learn more. They travel together and find seven strange beasts cut in stone.
Josh, at the end of Deadhouse Gates, there's this sequence where Shadow Throne kind of divvies out rewards almost, you know? Crocus and Absalar get to go to Absalar's home in Itko Khan. Kalam gets this stuff and he goes there, and he goes into the Warren of Shadows. And we check in with some of these characters here in Chapter 6, right? First, we meet Crocus and Absalar as they have gone back to Itko Khan, and we learn that they went to an alley and they had to get some money, so they killed this man, returned to Absalar's village, where her father dies, and we meet them kind of lost and confused what to do. How did you feel about checking in with these two characters?
I actually really enjoyed popping in with them. I've gone on the record that I don't enjoy Crocus. But I currently very much enjoy Cutter because if I don't know if you guys have seen or read Kick-Ass, but he has very strong vibes of the main character who just is like, I mean, his name's Cutter and he's gotten real good with daggers. And I don't think he's got it in him. Like, I don't know. And it's really funny. Everything about him going by that name is too much for me.
The reason I love Crocus, this chapter I love so much, and Crocus' character I adore, you know? Yeah. And maybe it's just because I am a somewhat confused, young, sad person, you know? Okay. But Crocus has... I feel so bad for him. This young boy truly has no clue what he should be doing.
Oh, no.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's just sitting around in this, like, he left Arujistan, went on a boat, followed this girl, and now they're back in her hometown, and he, like, killed a person, and is now like, I don't know, she likes me. I guess I'm a murderer now.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is he doing with his life, young man?
I think it's perfect. And I do also, I want to say that my favorite thing about this entire chapter is Crocus is just done with anybody and their shit. And nothing exemplifies that more than a god being like, you trying to do this? And him being like, well, I mean, let's bargain. And then he's not trying to get anything out of it, you know? I don't know. Their conversation is him just flagrantly being like, I could not give less of a shit about you, even though I guess you're my patron. I love that attitude.
He just doesn't know what to do or anything, you know?
Yeah. Also, I'd forgotten how much I enjoyed that he got rid of his coin, and I really enjoy his refusal to have his blades blessed. I think that's great.
India, how did you feel about checking in with Crocus and Absalar on Ed Kokan?
You know, I don't think that Crocus, aka Cutter, is being very genuine and true to himself here. I think he is just a very confused, sad little boy and is just like, well, I like this girl and she's a psycho, so same.
Like, Absalar's nice, but he's definitely...
Is she, though? She's, like, not really... Like, who is she at this point, you know? Like, she, like, can't really
Great
have
question.
Emotions at this point, I feel, because, like, I mean, I guess she does, but, like, everything just, you know, has to be a little more tempered because she's had some serious trauma in that little head of hers. So, you know, she's just not the woman that she was when they met, and Crocus is just looking for love in all the wrong places. My takeaway.
No.
I hope that his story gets more interesting, though. I mean, I'm so sick of all these freaking duos, you know?
It's a lot of pairs so far.
Like, okay.
A lot
like
of duos.
There's just so many freaking duos, and they are the least interesting by far.
Mad disagree, but they are going off to an island. Any thoughts about, like, why is Cotillion set? What's the goal? Do you guys
have
any thoughts?
Did he say which island? I can't remember.
No.
Just an island? I mean, are they going to go to Malaz Island? That'd be something, I guess.
I don't know anything about islands. I have no thoughts about where they're going. But I do like that Cutter has the ability to call on that cute little dog whenever he wants.
Oh my god. I forgot he gets the dog. That's pretty good.
Two dogs, right?
He meets two, but he
just
only
one.
Can... I think it was actually
he can
blind.
Summon.
Blind. He likes blind. Yeah, blind seems
blind.
Cool.
Blind makes him feel calm, which is adorable.
Just a fan of the pets, you know?
He's attracted to dangerous women, what it is.
I gotta tell you guys, I think the dogs are some of the most interesting characters in this whole series.
Really?
I hope we find... I mean, like, I fully could see them being just dogs, because Steve was just like, they got a lot of personality, sure. This one's called Gear. That's very up Steve's alley. But I could also see all of them being reincarnations of hyper-critically important people from the past. And
ooh,
just, like,
thought.
We don't know that till the end. But, like... I don't know. Either way, I would love it. I'd love if Steve was like, and this one's named Blind, and this one's named... Like, that's so good to me.
I think there was a really interesting part at the very beginning of Chapter 6 when Crocus is just thinking about what it means to, like, be in love with Absalar or whatever, and thinking
exactly.
about Cotillion and ascendancy and stuff. And he says, but it seemed to him to ascend was also to surrender.
Oh, that was great.
Was it not a mortal's fate then to embrace life itself as one would a lover, life with all its fraught momentary fragility? And could life not be called a mortal's first lover? A lover whose embrace was then rejected in the fiery crucible of ascendancy. It's a very good...
That's so good.
Very good.
I highlighted a similar thing about embracing life as a lover, which is it's wonderful and interesting. And I think it's especially a contrast to what could be given up by ascending. And then also, as you said, about in his current moment relating to Absalar and what it means to love and what it means to live. You know, I think it's a poignant passage. And
it's great.
That's why I love this. I loved him being sad on the beach. You know,
aren't we all just sad on the beach?
On Tuesdays.
Wait, did he also say that Absalar is ascending, or so he thinks? Did we all know that already? Is that, did I read that wrong?
I think she is slowly ascending.
Yeah, I think he was like just assuming based on her journey.
I feel like there's hints that like she's gonna do it, I guess. I feel like her choosing the fucking name of Absalar
right
kind of set her on that path.
So India, we then go into the Warren of Shadows where we check in with Kalam, and he has his own little conversation with Cotillion. We learn about Kalam's what he's been up to in the interceding time. How did you feel about checking in with this?
I loved it. I love it. I love that he is now a suburban dad with 13,000 children.
So many fucking kids.
It's fantastic. I thought that was interesting, kind of random. I forget about these little children that they're now raising to be an army, but I don't really know. Like, what, I wonder, well, are they alive is my first question at this point. Or are they like shadow?
Yeah, they're alive.
Okay. Wow.
So what do you think Cotillion's, what do you think Cotillion's game is?
He's cooking something up crazy, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know why it is, but he has a lot of different little things going on. I think having Kalam in his corner right now is going to be it's going to be a power move. I don't know. I can't fathom what they're doing. And also, what happened with him and Manala?
She's there.
I do think she gets short shrift, you know, and I do think it's pretty offhanded. He's just like, marital problems. Anyway, you should go on a quest,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, is he mad that she's teaching these children how to be like adept at life or what?
I think it's implied she is mad at him, but it's really, I don't know. It's referred to offhandedly. I don't
so
know
we
the
never
details.
Find out. We never, you know, I can't take it, but fine, whatever. I think it's interesting. It's gonna be great. Who knows what he's gonna do with these fighting children? Who knows what Kalam's gonna do? They're gonna take over the world is my new plan. Bye, Lassine. You're out of here.
Josh,
yes.
We then go into the flooded Warren where we check in with Troll from the prologue and we meet Onrak, a Talanai mass who is also trapped in this flooded Warren. How did you feel about meeting this new duo?
Well, first and foremost, Onrak will never replace Tool, my first and only clanless Talanai mass love. So he can forget about that right now.
See you.
Although he's kind of funny. I don't know. He's at least charming. I like Onrak a little bit so far. Troll Sengar is just kind of there and sad, which I guess when you've been stuck in eternal solitude, like hung on a wall, you would be. So I guess that's forgivable.
Do we know how long it's been?
Fucking ages.
A while, it's
yeah.
Implied.
Because India, when we start the book, this entire Warren, there is water, but it is not flooded to the point of it, like, you know, being
having
destroyed.
Having boats and stuff, yeah.
And it currently is now to the point of being destroyed. So, I don't know, I thought it was interesting. I was surprised. I don't know, actually, I got a really Karsa and Torvald Nam vibe from Onrak and Troll Sengar once Troll got his voice back. Because Onrak's like, I'm going to leave you here and die. And Troll's like, what if you didn't and I talked to you about enemies? And Onrak's like, are you enemy? And it's like, I just love it all. It's very Karsa and Torvald again. So I always love that kind of strong, silent type and then annoying, you know. It's a good one.
There's just a really good passage when they meet where Onrak's trying to find out why Troll is like chained there. And he basically just says, I'm plagued by the need to be truthful. And then Onrak's like, oh, I have my own curse, curiosity. And then he frees him. It's just like, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah. There we go. I'm excited for this duo. I have to say, I'm very curious. I even texted Peter. So I find it very curious that in this book, there are very many sevens.
Yeah, there's too many sevens. I texted Peter also because I was very confused about the seven dogs.
Yeah, so there's seven dogs, which are on the cover of this fucking book. So yeah. You'd imagine this is a pivotal thing we're about to see.
There's also seven
yeah,
cities.
So, there's seven
there's
cities. There's seven Tabor guides, you know. There's too many sevens.
Does Steve have a favorite number? And is it seven?
He got really into that Brad Pitt movie.
Oh my God.
So yeah, at the end, these big statues are on the cover of the book, and they know they sense something strange about them, and then there could be a gate out of the Warren past them. India, do you have any thoughts about these big, mysterious beasts of stone?
Which person has the dogs? Shadowthrone? Cotillion?
Shadowthrone.
Something to do with him. I'll tell you that much. That's all I got for you.
That
Two
was
dogs
my
are
thought.
Real.
Because we keep getting hints that like the Shadow Warren is not just one place and maybe many small places. So I was wondering if this is like somehow connected to, but I don't fucking know. Steve over here with his lairs.
I know. I'm like, ugh.
I too was like, ugh.
Oh, sorry. One last thing. When Onrak is talking, no, sorry. When Troll is talking about the Taste Eater and the Logros Talana Mast fighting, he says, prior to that, your people fled from us at first sight. And then, apart from those who traveled the oceans with Thaloman Toblachai.
Yes, that
which
was cool.
Makes my assumption, in my head, makes my assumption that the muddy current or whatever that was around Karsa's boat was, in fact, Talana Mast guiding his boat.
Ooh.
But I don't know. That was just something that I had thought about in the last section and feels like is a thing in my head. But
feels right.
That's interesting.
So that reminds me, how'd you guys feel? We get a little more information about the Tist Eater here. And Troll is the first Tist Eater we meet.
Well, besides all the one that Karsa stabs.
Yeah, he does kill many of them.
that is true. That's true. But they don't
count.
He didn't say, my name's Greg, and they get stabbed count, in the chest. Yeah.
All right, let's keep going to chapter 7. Chapter 7. In Reroku, Habora Ghost Hands collects flowers for tea. He thinks about delusions and the whirlwind when the child, now called Felicin Younger, joins him. They speak of Felicin's poetry, Korblo Dom's army, and the mages of the whirlwind. Shaik has banished Malak Rel to the chagrin of Korblo Dom. Habora goes to see Leoman, and they speak of Faith and the mage Bidathal, who has turned his attention to Felicin Younger. Haborik thinks Bidathal ought to be killed outright, but Leoman argues with him. Haborik goes off, and Karsa tells Leoman it's likely to find Shaik. Haborik goes to a decrepit temple and finds Bidathal. Before entering, Leoric emerges and warns Haborik about Bidathal. The Shadow Mage resides within, along with the amputated body of the still-living Silgar. Habork enters and threatens Bidathal with death if he touches Felicin Younger. Bidathal brags about the warded temple. They speak briefly about Habork's ghost hands, and then the ex-priest leaves. Karsa thinks on Habork, and then of Felicin. Fearing that she is being used by the whirlwind goddess, that she may be leading those into battle, similar to as Karsa once had. He also thinks of Leoman and what the man is waiting for. Karsa arrives then at a grove of stone and finds Felicin. He speaks about friends, the whirlwind goddess, and of poetry. Habork has visions of Jade and Fenir. He thinks more on these strange dreams, but tries to drink his tea to avoid the visions. He goes to Shaik's command, where the mages Leoric, Bidathal, and Febril have gathered along with the renegade fist Korblo Dom and his mage chemist Rilo. They speak of the first hero Treach and Fenir, then of Dujek's campaign on Genabacus and of Whiskey Jack's death. Genos' name is mentioned, and Felicin freezes. Everybody continues to debate the strength of the inexperienced adjunct Tavor and whether the noblewoman and her novice army will be a match to the whirlwind. Sheik abruptly dismisses everybody out, except for Haborik. Alone, then, Felicin cries out for her brother. Okay, Inge, we're finally back with the whirlwind. We check in with the rebellion on Seven Cities, starting with Haborik. He's collecting these flowers, and then he goes to speak with Leoman Karsa, and then later Bidathal. This is our first impression of the status of the rebellion on Seven Cities. So how'd you feel checking in with Haborik and then seeing what this rebel army looks like?
So Haborik, to me, is kind of annoying, because...
How dare you?
I know. Hear me out. I feel like him and Felicin's love-hate relationship is just so... It just carries on. It carries on. So in this, he's like, yeah, like, I don't know. I'm like, what are we doing here? This is a mess, blah, blah, blah. She's such a brat. But then at the end, he's like holding her while she cries, like, oh, my sweet child. So I'm just like over that. That's first of all. Second of all, they look to be in a pretty shitty shape right now. It seems like quite disorganized, a little bit chaotic, really with that whole guy whose name starts with a B, that's really also quite disturbing.
Bidathal.
So it and then all of that, and then nobody really seems to be like united in any, like, I don't really know, like, what they're doing together. Like, they all seem probably likely, most likely, to have their own separate agendas under the guise of this whirlwind thing. So I don't know. I'm kind of interested in seeing, like, what will happen when there is conflict and how everyone individually is going to react to that. And Corbolo Dom is blue, which is news to me.
Yes.
And that's it.
Napping. Josh, how did you feel about finding Haboric and also the state of the Rebel Army?
Well, I actually started this chapter very cold. I, like, really didn't. I've said before that I think that the desert setting just is, it ingrains itself into every part of this chapter for me.
I think, well, Steve does a great job of making you feel
terrible
in the desert.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I felt shitty. Like, as soon as I got in there, I felt shitty. I felt Haboric's just, like, need for dreamless sleep. And that like, was weighing on me the whole time. Like, I felt so bad for this dude. But also, like, there's so many things he did in the second book and is still doing that I'm like, dude, fucking, I want to have pity for you. I want to empathize with you so bad. Stop doing shitty, dumb things.
Like, exactly.
That it's just, it's very hard. It's very hard for me to get into his head and empathize.
What specifically are you calling shitty and dumb?
I think he is too convinced that he's the smartest man in the room in any fucking room he walks into.
I don't know.
I'd say the prime example is him talking with Toblakai and Leoman, because I think they're his only allies basically in this camp, because Felicent's too quick to just turn on the drop of a dime could be, hate him again. And I feel like Toblakai and Leoman are very like stable. They don't want to have sex with children, and we don't think that they could possibly be scheming overlord high mages, you know?
I do think you make a good point there, in that I do think in that conversation with Leoman and Toblakai, Karsa, you know, you can say what you want about Leoman and Karsa, but they're like they're just as smart as Haboric.
Yes.
And he definitely is talking down to them.
Yeah.
Or at least he like isn't giving them the respect of an equal.
Drives me crazy. That made me pretty. And granted, I think I have a much different perspective on that scene after, you know, book one of this one. Now that I like see Toblakai as a character that I like understand and really see where they're coming from. If he trusts Leoman, then there's a part of me as a reader that wants to trust Leoman as well. And so in the second book, I didn't really care when Haboric was mean to them, but now it really grates me.
Well, let's check in on that, Josh. How are you feeling? We see more about it. How are you feeling about Leoman right now? Because I feel like he is a character who we saw in book two, we haven't really talked about.
Yeah.
And now we know him again kind of through Karsa's eyes, and we see him here talking to Haboric.
You know, I actually was kind of annoyed with like his. So, okay, at the end of book two, it's not that he is like not. He was just really, really close with Shaik Elder. Yes, correct. And so he doesn't take to. Is it like he questions Felicent on the way in, right? Enough to the point that he kind of loses some favor with her?
I thought he didn't.
Yeah, I think.
What?
I think Felicent says something about his heart being bereft of fate.
Yeah.
Faith?
Yeah.
There's an exact line
it's,
I forget.
It's good. But I don't know. So I was, at first, I actually fully believed that he was just like getting high all the time and was just giving up. I actually was not, when they later say that like no one actually ever sees him do it, I was just like, I didn't see that coming actually. That's cool. So I don't really know. He's hard to put a finger on. Obviously, he's the only reason Karsa's alive. I don't know. He's a very interesting character. I would say he's one of the characters I'm most interested to learn more about.
India, it goes without saying, we go and meet the quite despicable Bitathol in his dark evil lair.
Yeah.
And I use the word evil very pointedly, you know. Not a word I bandy about, but. So any impressions or thoughts about Bitathol and why we're keeping him around and this mage who is a part of the rebellion?
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that he has to be like some kind of crazy strong like magical being that's like really useful, which I kind of got just because like was really that cocky that they don't even turn around when somebody like walks into their home and they just like remain doing what they're doing, even though they like, I don't know. I just felt like he knew. He's just a weird guy. He's very overconfident, I feel. And I think that I don't know what he brings to the table that they'd keep him around, or that he'd even feel like why he's even still here, knowing that he's like, you know, an evil character. So I have a feeling maybe, I don't know, we got to learn a little bit about who he is before, because I don't know. I feel like there has to be some reason. They can't just, he wouldn't just be there to be there. And he also seems like, yeah, you don't want to try that. Like when he's like, you could try to kill me. Many have, and I'm sure many will after you. So I don't know. He seems kind of like, you know, fuerte, strong, scary.
I also completely forgot, all cop to that, at the end of chapter 4, I completely forgot about the Silgar plotline and what happens to this character.
Loved it.
However, seeing him again in this chapter, it all instantly snapped back into memory. You know, I all recall this whole thing now. So, Josh, how'd you feel about seeing Silgar now chilling out in this terrible pain form?
Chilling out is a generous phrase.
It's a little rough, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, I think,
wanted to shout it out. You know?
I think Karsa should just kill him. That'd be probably a good choice.
Coming out of his little things. Yuck.
So then, Josh, Karsa goes, and we get his perspective, kind of on the status of the Rebel Army and Leoman and the Whirlwind Goddess. And then he goes and talks with Felicin, and we get a chance to see her. So how'd you feel about seeing Karsa here? And then how'd you feel about seeing Felicin from the eyes of Karsa Orlon?
It's the first time in a long time that I didn't immediately dislike her. I enjoyed their scene together. I thought it was nice.
Josh likes Felicin behind Karsa's eyes.
Yeah, it's just because Karsa's too nice and naive to understand that she's the pits.
In a world where Karsa is too nice.
Yeah, nice is not the right word.
Where are they that there were all those snakes and stuff? I was trying to understand.
Just nearby, but like...
They're in the encampment. There's like a garden of stones and Karsa's like carving junk in them and a bunch of snakes, I guess.
It was really nice that he carved one of his companions.
That fucking got
thanks
me.
To his that thanks to his actions are dead, you know. It's like... I gotta tell you, chapter one Karsa, I don't think understood remorse. So he's really come a long way.
Yeah.
Or even grief.
India, how did you feel about checking in with Felicin here? And also, Karsa talks about fearing for Felicin and whether she's being used and worrying about her. So do you share any of those fears? And how did you feel checking in with Felicin?
Always love Felicin. It's always a joy to read her. I don't really know. I have no freaking idea what is going on with this grouping. There are so many stronger like people and strong people that are around her. I'm just confused as to, I just don't know. I don't know. I feel like what decisions really has she even made yet? And also we haven't really seen any conflict. So I can't really, I don't really have anything to base it off of, I feel. Like, if she's being used, and by who, and what they're planning on doing. It's just, like, way too soon for me to make that call.
I think Steve does such a good job, and it's why Felicin's story shines so bright in Deadhouse Gates to me. In that, you know, when she takes the title of Shaiq Reborn, you know, it is, to me, it's a very satisfying moment. It's like a moment of empowerment, you know? It's like a moment of actualization. She's coming into her own in a way, you know? And then when you're outside of her character, you know, and when you're not in her own shoes feeling her emotions, you look back at it from the outside perspective, from her context of being this stranger, being drawn into this army, being given this huge position, you know, and being donned this power by the Whirlwind Goddess, you know, it puts it in such a different context. And I think it speaks to how powerful it is that when you read it from her perspective, it's such a different experience than when you're looking at it from Karsa or an outside perspective, because you're right experiencing it from her point of view.
Yeah, I definitely think when it was from her point of view, it felt a lot more empowering. Ooh, my cat just attacked the other one. My apologies. It sounded a lot more empowering. She sounded, you know, just very in charge, at peace, whatever, all knowing. But everybody else, I feel, when they're talking about her, is just like,
oh my
stop.
God.
Damn.
You're so annoying. Stop. sorry. Sorry.
Assert yourself, India. Assert yourself.
Yeah. It's so bad. I don't even remember what I was saying. But either way, the people looking at her through other people's eyes, it just seems as though she's, you know, she's not it. She ain't it, is what it seems like. And nobody is confident in her abilities. So you know what? Felicent's going to shine through as she always does, and she's going to crush it. Following up with my next question, does everybody know that her and Tavor are sisters?
Ooh, that's a good question.
No.
They don't even know. Do they even know that her name is originally Felicent? Because she shows up and she's like, I'm Shaik, right?
Well, she named the one young girl Felicent Younger and kind of adopted this child. But outside of that, I think she mostly goes by Shaik.
Cool. Yeah, that makes... Yeah, so... it'd be pretty shitty if they all found out, huh? What would that mean, huh?
Yeah.
I wonder. The plot thickens.
So, Josh, Haboric has some visions that he is burdened by. And then... he goes, and in almost like a parallel of the Tavor sequence, she goes to her own command meeting, and there are the mages, there's Corblo Dom and Camus Relo, and they talk about the events of Memories of Ice. Mm-hmm. They talk about Tavor, and they kind of check in with the whole situation. So, and then there's the kind of ending tag we'll talk about separately. So how'd you feel about seeing, seeing this command room and getting all of this information from the perspective of this tent of rebel leaders?
My heart was broken when they were just so happy about all the people who died. Because I was like, they're beautiful souls and they didn't deserve this. So I was very upset by that. I do believe Felicent has her work cut out for her compared to Tavor. Because like, it's just an example of like, Tavor being groomed for her leadership role. You know, like she just sets meetings and appointments and she says what she has to say and she goes. And Felicent doesn't get any of those advantages. You know, she's just kind of thrown into this command. And, like, can you imagine being in a room with, like, that many people who all believe they are, like, the most... like, they all believe in Shaik, however much we believe that they do. But, like, you know that secretly all of them are like, I'm the real leader of this and trying to just worm their way into everything. I could not... That would be tough for anybody to try and command, so...
And it's worth noting, we skimmed over earlier, Shaik made the decision to excise Malak Rel from the camp.
Yes.
So he is gone.
Right. But the whole time, it was overwhelming. And the number of people that you had to, like, just meet in that one moment, it was a lot. It did a good job of, like, showing just how fractured, in some ways, it feels like this Army of Rebellion is.
Absolutely. I think it does a great job of, not only were told that, in meetings like this, you really see firsthand the fracturing you're talking about. India, how'd you feel at the very end? Felicent hears about Perrin being, Ganois being alive, and she misses her brother.
I loved it. I live for Felicent showing emotions and her and Haboric being besties. I don't know what it means. No idea. Couldn't tell you. Have no idea how these stories are going to come together, but I really hope that if they do find each other, it's a positive storyline. And not, him trying to kill her because she's Shaik reborn. But yeah, that was really cute. I just wish that her and Haboric could always just be like that, you know? Like, why can't they always just be supporting each other instead of arguing all the time? It's like, just freaking get it together, guys. Great ending. Loved it. Needed it because I couldn't take the, them not being besties.
Yeah.
I also loved the parallel. Steve uses similar language about her being like a child, when Bodhi dies, of her collapsing into Haboric's arms. And I just think it's an interesting to retouch on that metaphor of having exterior armor and then kind of having more naive, younger, more intimate version of yourself within.
Don't we all?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's used a lot, right? AJ?
Yes.
How are the levels?
How are the levels?
The levels are good.
AJ, how are you feeling right now about the rebellion in contrast to Adjunct Tavor's army? You know, because we start out chapter 5, we meet Tavor and the Malazans, and now we check in with Shaik and we check in with the rebels.
Yeah.
So where are you at?
I think, I don't remember which one of you said it, India and Josh, but one of you said that you realize how like unprepared they are. Or just like how broken apart the rebellion seems. I very much feel that they are just kind of like, oh, we have all this information, but like, I don't know. Also, we're kind of just in the middle of the desert.
Literally.
It's just like, I don't know. The Tavor's army seems way more of like a proper military, I guess. Whereas the rebellion, I mean, I guess that is kind of the definition of like what a rebellion kind of is like a collection of people coming together. But like, it just, that is what it feels like, despite like, it seems like they have all these very powerful people on the side of Shaik and stuff, but it doesn't feel like they're being managed super well. Mm-hmm. And it just feels, it feels like there is a child leading them, which like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it all is going to depend on like a big, they're making a big deal right now about how the Malazan army, like the actual troops are fresh and untested, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like, and I feel like it's going to come down to, can they maintain their level, like the level of discipline that, like if they can stay disciplined, maintain their ranks, survive in the desert, I think they're mm-hmm. going to fucking win, no doubt. It's just a matter of if they can do that, you know, raw and untested.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree, but I also feel like they do have this big desert god on their side, you know? So like,
it's true.
You know, it could go pretty south for the Empire pretty quick, I think. Before we wrap up this chapter, can I just read this final paragraph? Because it's,
please,
it's so, so good. She wept for a long, long time, and he held her tight, unmoving, as solid as he could manage. And each time the vision of his fallen god rose before his mind's eye, he ruthlessly drove it back down. The child in his arms, for child she was once more, cried in nothing other than the throes of salvation. She was no longer alone, no longer alone with only her hated sister to taint the family's blood. For that, for the need his presence answered, his own grief would wait. I just feel like it's a really good moment for Haboric also, just like internally and stuff. And just, I don't know.
It's almost like Steve's really, really, really good at writing.
Yeah.
I think the most interesting word choice he uses there is salvation.
Yeah.
You know,
right?
To touch back on the interiority of it is because I think in that passage, he's saying she is finding salvation through connecting with emotion and connecting with her inner feelings and like kind of opening up that armor, you know?
Yeah. And I think that kind of speaks to India, what you were saying about her never, not really revealing her emotions and stuff, is like, she wasn't doing that because she didn't feel like she had a reason to.
Right.
And now that Perrin is like alive, you know, she feels like that part of her can also still survive, you know?
Well, that she can live almost in a way.
Right.
You
that
know?
She, yeah, that she, that, that she can be Felicin, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
Well, that'll be all for us this week. As always, we're 10 Very Big Books on Twitter and Gmail. Let us know what you think of the show. Before we go, do we have any predictions for going forward now that, for the most part, we've checked in with most of the people from Dead House Gates?
We literally have. They're literally all in different places, and their stories I couldn't even tell you how they're gonna meet, but here's my prediction: they all will meet.
That's a cold take. Shit. That's not a hot take. Okay, Josh, do you got any predictions for what's gonna happen to all these new characters? Not new, returning.
I was gonna guess that we're gonna see Mappo and Icarium. That was gonna be my guess.
All right,
I feel like they gotta publish somewhere.
Do you have any fun hot predictions?
Not about these characters specifically, but I was thinking about the Tyst Eater stuff that we got. Mm. And I was thinking maybe we'll get some insight into the city that Lady Envy walked through on her way to Coral in the last book. Right? Was that a Tyst Eater city?
I know
that was not a Tyst Eater city, but
there is a dead Tyst Eater in the river that the Bridge Burners find.
Yeah. So I think maybe we'll get a throwback to Memories of Ice, maybe.
I would like that.
Just a quick other thing. I do love that when the Rebel Army is talking about the events of Memories of Ice. I love when the world's so big that in world they're discussing things we read about secondhand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. It kind of makes you feel the scope of the world when they're like, yo, the word just got in from Genabacus. They're fighting something called the Pinian Domin, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was really something that really struck me was I knew the armies were big and stuff and like they lost a lot of people. But for them to say like, oh, Dujek's army of 10,000 lost 7,000 was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
To like give it a number was like wild.
Yeah. I'm very curious who their man on the inside is, who like literally knew the names of the Breach Burners. Like that's got to be someone up there.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
all
my
right,
prediction.
Everybody.
Fuck you, India.
I say come. You say passion. Come. Passion.
Passion.
All right. I got to say, I think we're. All right. God bless.
See ya.
Hello, everybody. Producer AJ here. Now, acutely aware of the fact that I just said goodbye on the show and then hello immediately after. Thank you so much for listening to the third episode of our read-through of House of Chains. We recorded this episode a few days after launching our Patreon, and we were clearly blown away by the response, and that remains true now, nearly a month after its launch. Thank you to everybody who's backed the show so far. We're almost at $300 a month at the release of this episode, and geez, we love you all for that. Thank you so much. If you'd like to check out our Patreon, you can visit the link in the show notes or head on over to patreon.com/10verybigbooks. There's a great public post on there that explains exactly how we want to use this money that we're making from this. So if that interests you at all, head on over and give it a read. Of course, you can always tweet us your thoughts and feelings about the show at 10verybigbooks. You can also email us 10verybigbooks@gmail.com. You can also join our Discord by heading to bit.ly/VBBDiscord. That's capital V, capital B, capital B, capital D, Discord. The link will also be in the show notes. And as always, thank you so very much to Dan Geserich for making our spectacular logo. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Geserich for a tweet that just says, I enjoy hockey, as if we didn't already know. And of course, the wonderful music in today's episode is by the one and only Amaranthin from their album Simulant Rain, which you can find along with their other music on bandcamp.com. Links to their pages will be in the show notes, and 10 Very Big Books will be back in 2 weeks on August 14th, talking about House of Chains, chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. We'll talk to you then, and thank you so much for listening.
Before we get started, I was watching K-pop before this when I was studying. You know, I really feel like our podcast should also aspire to be like a K-pop group where our distinguishing features are all we're slightly different flavors of incredibly beautiful. Do you know what I mean?
I do agree with that already.
Yeah,
like I'm kind of like a smoldering beautiful, and then Josh is like a cute beautiful.
Oh,
you know,
ow.
And then like India is like also a cute beautiful, but kind of a different cute. I just think it's nice how in K-pop groups everyone identifies as incredibly hot, but just like slightly different. You know,
yeah,
for sure, for sure.
And AJ can have like blue hair. That's his thing.
I would have blue hair.